Blog Talk Radio.
Connected again. Hello and welcome to Masonic Effects. It's a place where we can, just for a little while, chew over aspects of masonry that make it what it is today. A place for us to join together in a moment of contemplation. Not to dwell on it, too much of a good thing, you know, but to think about some of the important issues. Now, these aren't important to everybody all the time, but some of the time, this is where we want to be a little bit provocative, eh? Want to just give us an opportunity to think a little bit. Anyway, it's only 15 days until Christmas. We're using the Georgian calendar where I am. And I have the fire crackling on behind me. I don't know if you can hear that. And, a cup of espresso here to kickstart the show. And I think you're going to enjoy it. The narrative today, the commentary, I think, is really interesting. The ideas that build up to time waits for no Mason. Mm-hmm. This is a place for Freemasonry to get on with the business of Freemasonry through a different kind of a connection. Can't get to as many people in person as we can through the airwaves. And I know, yes, okay, it's old school in a way, but we're making good use of something that's familiar. And the fact that I'm some distance from you or very close to you is unimportant. What is important is that we have a chance to connect. I think you're going to enjoy the program today and the music that has been put together to, you know, underline some of the points. It's like God could not be everywhere, and therefore he made mothers. Rudyard Kipling said that. I think today it's, if you have just a sense of nostalgia, you'll enjoy this. I think you'll, I'm going to be talking more and speaking more and more about our work as amateur, or I would instead of using the word amateur, I would say natural. We're natural biographers as Freemasons. We embrace the idea that that we are creatures of memory. We don't say that out front. Do you think that we're creatures of memory? It's self-evident. Other creatures may have facial recognition, but you and I, we don't know quite yet. We can't quite measure it. So we are using the best science that we have based on the best equipment we have, right? Perhaps animals at some level are associating memories. First time they met that face, what does the familiarity generate? Well, for the likes of you and I, it's like an artist's palette. It's really limitless to the time or what was just happening before you had those encounters. The interesting, I think there's so many times when we just need a different vocabulary to help us to articulate the position of masonry. And it's not a struggle. We know, you know what it is. Without necessarily, it's one of those quirky, those little paradoxes. How do you know something without, how do you understand something without knowing it? Well, you understand the nature of masonry, but do you know it? And it gives us a pause to do some work, to put together some study and observations. There's many ways we can do this. We can go to the library and study and learn the language that we need in order to describe an esoteric aspect of life. Not everybody would do that. And do we have to? Well, come on now. We're past the age where anybody gives a nod to accept the order to your self-development. If you don't want to, if you're digging your heels in, well, you know, that's the nature of you. But we have this craving, this curiosity, and that never stops. It started when you and I were boys, or you and I were girls. And I'm not talking about that zygotic. Yeah, I am. That notion that at a certain point in development, we are all women. Do the science yourself to find, if you're curious about that. It's as if Kipling were reading us, you know, reading or looking over our shoulders. He says, if history were taught in the form of stories, it would never be forgotten. You and I are when we're at the knee of our mentors, we're taught stories, allegories, yes, and fantastical imagery, yes. We talk about a state of perfection. We're talking about a utopia. And then we start to assimilate some of those ideas and break it down. The difficulty. We could have utopia, except the administration of utopia would be oppressive. So many rules, so many dire consequences that would make it unlivable. So we have a utopia in our minds. We have 40 million reasons for failure, but not a single excuse. Yeah, that's us. Lots of reasons. If they're not there, we can go out and find them. We'll find a reason to fail. You know, here we talk, we communicate. Words are, of course, the most powerful drug used by mankind. The state of the world today is remarkable. It is evolving. Social context, social discourse is evolving. And our partners are striving. Why did we do as much as we could to encourage the equality of women? We've been, I think, waiting for this moment where now we stand up. We stand up and we endorse the issues that are generated by our partners because they are women. Here, the silliest woman can manage a clever man, but it needs a very clever woman to manage a fool. Women aren't given their rights by men. They are creatures in their own right. They are. They have. If you can, and Kipling helps us enormously. You know, we would do well. Well, you and I, brethren, we're taught this repeatedly. The arts and sciences provide us with so much insight, so much information from the welder's arc, looking through the lens. What does that, the science around that, to the wood chopper's efforts, the hunters who turn into conservationists. They know that they have to balance the and preserve the conditions for the existence of wildlife. We lose the habitat, we lose wildlife. Tragically, now where I am in the world, we're seeing polar bears starving. I feel without words to describe it. Do you see that actually happening? The consequence of our folly will be visited upon us. And the expressions of that consequence will come to us through natural law. No appeal. Whether it's harsh or not, there is no valence to it. It is what it is. And bearing witness to global warming, the deniers all aside, doesn't matter. There's still, you know, people, we read about what we did to scientists. The apologies hundreds of years later are hollow. The science was teaching us about our connection with the universe. It was assaulting, in a way, the mythology of the day, and the people were murdered for it. We have polite terms. The apology matters little. That's an expression of us. Now the consequences are going to be known to us. The adjustment, where we can in our minds understand what adjustments we need to make. Our lifestyle will have to change in order to support and sustain our climates. And are we willing to park our cars and give up plastics? Oh, not quite. We're still thinking we have a choice. Nature is the ultimate power. And like Einstein, I find, I'm a deist. I find nature is, if you want the expression of a creator, go into nature. That's the creator is around us. It is us. If you can keep your wits about you while all others are losing theirs and blaming you, the world will be yours and everything in it. What's more, you'll be a man, my son. Here's a little homage. This is a little recognition that we're coming up to the winter where I am and summer where you are. I'm sitting at the lingering parts of autumn during that transition period. And everything passes on really nicely. The overlap. This is a song by a trumpet player, Chet Baker. Chet found comfort in for a time in a way that was a bit self-destructive. He was a session man for many, many years, and he would sing, and the people, the artists, the musicians that he sat down with would say to him, "Chet, you have a really good voice. Why don't you do some recordings?" And, "Oh, no. I've got my horn." And eventually he did start to produce some work. Now, you judge for yourself. He seemed a solemn person, but he speaks to us the way the painters and poets do. Through their art, you and I speak to the world through our deeds, and we're part of that little bundling process, those fibers that fit together. I'm not talking about the fibers of plastic that are scientists know are floating around in the air. more so in the United States than any other over any other country. Nor am I suggesting that we're able to escape. That stuff is everywhere. We're a fiber in a different way. We're a fiber that is part of that cord, that spinal cord, that energy that gives us the ability to perform and think and move. Chet Baker's Autumn Leaves. This is from a little while ago. Let's see what you think of this voice. He's doing a duet here. It's from albums he did when he's in the Italian sessions, I think, yeah.
Drift by my window. The autumn start to fall.
there's a message in all of that. Old Desmond. Chet Baker. I think you'll like that. Hope so. The it's been, a fan of Russian poetry here. Clumsily wading through the cultural background of that very interesting nation to try and understand. I think it's important, instead of making rash assumptions or being led around. I'm of a mind that quietly, in your own way, you're drawn to Masonry because you're not gullible. It's not because you are gullible or you want to be led. It's because you're not. And you're not being gullible suggests that it's difficult for you to accept prima facie the influences around you, church and state, that you question. You're looking for, that song, is that all there is? Well, yeah, you're looking for more. You're looking for a way, I think, of accessing that information so it has an application, that it has meaning. We're going to get into a little bit about the soul of the earth. That's the work of poets, to tell us about the emotional state of the actual world around us. I've found a really interesting writer that I think, at least 20th century. Well, I know that's a little bit of a departure. I apologize. If it's not 18th or 17th, it just doesn't happen. This writer said, "No foreign sky protected me. No stranger's wing shielded my face. I stand as witness to the common lot, survivor of that time, that place," 1961. Anna Akhmatova. She's better known by the... That was her pen name. Irian Vigorenko, one of the most significant Russian poets of the 20th century. She died on the 5th of March in 1966. Here, I'd like to read just one of her poems for you. She did this in 1916. "As a white stone in the well's cool deepness, there lies in me one wonderful remembrance. I am not able and don't want to miss this. It is my torture and my utter gladness. I think that he whose look will be directed into my eyes at once will see it whole. He will become more thoughtful and dejected than someone hearing a story of a dole. I knew the gods turned once in their madness men into things, not killing humane senses. You've been turned into my reminiscence to make eternal the unearthly sadness." The girl writes. She writes, and it resonates. It resonates. Biographers, each one of you, wonder what does that type of thing matter to me? Well, it matters if you look at it as taking a brush in your hand and dipping it into a pot of paint without having a choice of what color or the tone. Dipping it into a pot and challenging yourself to put it to canvas or to paper and to express an idea, not to draw a rock or draw a bunny or draw a tree, although Dürer would certainly taught us but that was a long time ago. But to express a story, a monochrome, one color. Have at it. What would you want to have around you to inspire you? Where would you begin, you could say? What would you want around you to inspire you? Well, would it be music? Would it be the reason that the composer put the music together? Would it be the work of the librettist, matching the words to this song, to this tune, to the music? Would it be the expression of a dancer? Would it be Butterfly realizing that her English hero has abandoned her for another woman? That crushing emotion, that loss, and yet the enduring obsession with love. Who describes those types of things? The black and white, the certainly miss that. In your painting, it's going to need to be as nuanced as you are. Is everything that you do and think self-evident to everyone around you? That's foolish, I know, but here I want you to think about, we just stepped through history here together. So I want to talk to you about, give you this notion, this expression today, time waits for no Mason, the comment. The Greek gods had human failings like jealousy and greed, avarice and narcissism, along with great powers. Citizens of Athens lived within a canon that determined a daily devotion each day to a different god. Yeah. Do we need to believe there is an end of time? Often misunderstood, the ancient Greeks referred to this as the apocalypse, being a word that in Greek means pulling back the veil. Pulling back the veil, not an end. Some faiths teach devotees that each ending marks a new beginning. This is the influence. So let's make right some of the misunderstandings that have happened around us. Here. Speaking of the language of enlightenment, being a product of that, we will never know precisely what it was like to live a life attentive to enlightened ideals. Some European men and a few women sought to express those ideals sociably within the parameters set by private fraternizing. Within those limits, the Masonic lodges were by far the most cosmopolitan and internationally connected enclaves of the century. To know them and how their idealism related to the Enlightenment, we must go by what Masonic orators said lodges and brothers should be, as well as by what letters, meeting records, and diaries may have to tell us. Vast reconstructions have been attempted for the much more public thought of the famous philosophies, the supposed originators of the Enlightenment. Voltaire, Rousseau, Diderot, and in the American colonies, Franklin. Wow. These really go through quite a battering lately as the light changes from dawn to full afternoon, doesn't it? We re-examine who these people are and their role in history. My goodness, are we in for a few surprises, huh? But they were the grand men of the Enlightenment. Ooh. I'll start to say people. I don't want to belittle the role of women anymore. No. I was that man when I was a boy. I was that man when I was ignorant, but I can't be anymore. I know better. And it's not that I'm casting aspersions on men. It's that I'm different now. These were the people of the Enlightenment, not the little people who so often admire them. Much has been made of the official academies, particularly in France, as the loci of the Enlightenment's followers. But to make clear in the conclusion, the few thousand academicians familiar with the light were also officially sponsored. In most European countries, the lodges except occupied a middle ground, a place where the occasional government official might be found, but one which was nevertheless officially suspect. We need to listen to the less famous, less official voices of Masonic brothers who addressed one another monthly at various European countries and languages. We do that to recapitulate and generalize about Masonic ideals as found throughout Western Europe. In the process, we want to render the Enlightenment into the property of the Freemasons, but we do not want to render the Enlightenment into the property of the Freemasons, but rather to show the brothers and sisters as consumers, interpreters, and appliers. Masonic idealism was reconstructed in specific contexts, first within one Amsterdam lodge and then within various French lodges. The records of the Amsterdam lodge, unlike almost any French lodge, are so abundant for the 1790s and earlier that they're an amazing source of detail and information. We need to hear from as many European and Masonic voices as is feasible to recapture the universality of Masonic discourse. We need to examine not only orations, but also pocket-sized almanacs. If some of you might be able to find them, they're very brittle these days. They're so popular and commonplace amongst the brothers. They were small and fragile, and few of these Masonic almanacs have survived, but in size and purpose, they were the equivalent of our daily diaries and calendars. And their daily usefulness was matched only by their value as traveling companions. They included locations of lodges all over Western Europe, and almost invariably they contained orations and songs that could help pass the time. The concession to publish them was highly prized amongst Masonic publishers. In the publishing heartland of Europe, the Dutch Republic, Johann Schroeder, this was the leader in the 1750s of La Bien Amie, and we've talked about that lodge much earlier, a couple of years ago here on Masonic Effects. He was the official publisher of Masonic Effects and of Masonic Almanacs in both Dutch and French texts. So we know that this work is available and gives us insights that go beyond to fill in the official record. But, and here's the value for us of arts and sciences, it casts a wider net into literature, lofty and mundane, and because we're seeking to recapture how men and women identified with the Age of Enlightenment and how those people sought to articulate their prescriptions for living it. You know, as you and I go through our business, let's say the idea of masonry is to be good, be so good that they can't ignore you. Be so good that they can't, that you're remembered because of the goodness of your acts. To recite a poem in the local literary society, to give the results of experimentation in a philosophical society, and to extort brothers and sisters in lodges were all part of the training of people newly empowered to speak in private. Can you imagine? And now we have that opportunity and we hardly use it. It's like having a collection of albums of the greatest singers in the world and not using them because the technology has gone on. Well, the music is still there. Now I can sit here. You and I can have access to every bit of music ever created in the face of the earth. we need, in order to access this, we need to educate one another. We need to take seriously the words of a French art, our 1782, the sanctuary of Masonic friendship and fraternity is consecrated by the voices of their orators. The sanctuary of Masonic friendship and fraternity is consecrated by the voices of their orators. Just as Masonic Effects has its critics because it's out there to the in the airwaves, there seems to be an unstated sense of loss. A loss in the sense of being those voices, those orators consecrating the sanctuary. So why do we not throw our shutters wide open to the world? Because we have this sense of sanctuary. Have you been to, maybe you've been like, all right, this isn't a competition. I was in St. Paul's. And at a certain time, St. Paul's Cathedral is the curates will tell all of the tourists to settle down, put their cameras away. There's moments for, it is, after all, a place of worship, a place of sanctuary. Have you been to the other, have you been to cathedrals? You've been to Westminster when this happened? Whoa, very clear. You're not to be in there gaping and gawking while people are observing sanctuary, are going through a religious ceremony, or experiencing an expression, a celebration of their faith. Similar with Masonry. Now, we wouldn't know that today. We can't and shouldn't mock our children because they take advantage of things that are commonplace to them. We shouldn't. And to compare them to our day is unrealistic. They have no idea what the experience is like. We can tell them, but they don't have any. You know, it's like great-grandpa. Great-great-grandpa is going to tell me, this is what it felt like to jump into the struggle to get into the seat of Sopwith Camel. Oh, no, you don't have a parachute there, lad. And, oh, yeah, bundle up. It's going to be a wee bit cold. We can hear it and we can imagine. But we can't really, I think, know that, understand that notion of the challenge. We hear about the romantics, how the romantic sense of war just before the First World War broke out. We still had that. The young valiants that would want to take on this new technology, the flying aircraft, knowing that their life expectancy in the air would be, what, 2 or 3 weeks? It was the gallantry. It was what drove Pushkin to duel. It wasn't that life didn't matter. It was that expression that life is honor, and honor manages, and it's a truth of existence. To the death, to risk your life in pursuit of a noble act. Today, we know men and women come back from battle, have difficulty with that transition from being taught that they're no longer a person, that we have to strip away identity, individual identity, for the sake of uniformity needed to execute these a large-scale military adventures and military soirees. And then when we come back into so-called civilian life, the individual is, again, all-important. But we don't really have a well-articulated path to change from working in the collective being trained and trained in that way. We don't call it brainwashing because it's not accurate. Brainwashing is malevolent. Yes, it may well be, but this is done purposefully. And we don't have a path to, we don't have the prescription for taking a person, putting them into some kind of industrialized purpose, and then taking them back. Some can, and some do, and many do. But we know that there are the tragedies that have difficulty and wrestle with that. And so what do? They'll feel more comfortable being part of that. You know, you don't have the individuality. That's why we have a uniform. And it's not Graham killing, it's me as part of an army doing my duty. We don't have that yet. We will. But to think, do we judge the thinking of the nobility, the people, that the sons that weren't going to carry on the business of gentrification? They were going to put themselves out there to express their courage, even though it meant certain death. Now, do we understand that mindset today through our rules of engagement? That's some may, but certainly I think not in passing, and certainly I don't think it's a casual gesture. And yet, there is nobility in the acts. We express a nobility. We carry it forward, as paradoxically as it may be. We carry forward that we just acknowledge that. Not that the world is a cemetery and every tree needs to have a commemorative plaque to, every forest needs to be full of the dead. Our brethren in the men and women in Russia will know this much better than us. They have whole volunteer groups of volunteers digging through the forests and finding people that were buried during the wars. They're still doing that. And then they're brought forward for proper burial. Now, we honor our dead soldiers. Is it different? I don't think it's reasonable to expect that I could see the 17th century in the same way. Just as can we think about what it was, what it felt like for people to embrace the freedoms of the Enlightenment. I think that's asking a great deal. Here. We'll come back to it. Was it different in France than in Britain? Yeah, oh my goodness. Yes, of course. Here. This is Manel Mondhar. This is by Charles Trinet. Wrote this in 1938. Yeah.
Mais oui, madame, c'est là que je vais, c'est mon cœur, c'est là que je viens retrouver mon âme, toute ma flamme, tout mon bonheur, oh, pour te revoir, ma petite église, les mariages, allégument, je vois encore ma belle maison grise, où même la brise, par le vent tend. Elle me raconte, comme autrefois, de jolis contes. Je passais de vous revoir un rendez-vous. Une musique, mes yeux rêveurs. Tout un roman d'amour. Thank you.
Understand a little more about the brethren. I think broadened our access to masonry. They began to print things very cautiously, very carefully, and very quietly. That Pythagorean notion of silence really does give a certain currency. It has a certain value. Quietly. It's not what we do. Do we bring a lot of attention to it? When we want to decry everything, if we're going to do something, we want to do it in a ham-fisted kind of a way. That's a very repellent manner to take with any issue. We do it with some called quiet diplomacy. Not out in the streets throwing rocks, although we may need to do that, we may feel that need to express our dissatisfaction. Here, throughout the 18th century, especially from the 1740s, that would be a time we had our constitution was being formed and the order had history, and that surge that... The growth at the start of anything, there's an enthusiasm and a novelty to it, and that began to shift, just like the crest of the wave. And there was, those intellectual discourse didn't have the same kind of resonance as it did at the start. It changed. Well, gee, you think? It's like, are you and I going to have the same conversation today as we would have had in 1964? We've learned to live under the with the idiocy of the global threat and knowing that. We didn't create the five earlier extinctions, so we didn't do that, but we created our own version of it. So all of a sudden, we've calculated that we can now annihilate everything. So we learn to live with that existential threat. We, our children and our children's children, grow up with that sense of existential threat. Everything gone. Because what? Some people, it better not be a decision made by the stupid, but I imagine that that's always been the case. If you can conjure up the stupidity being that you can make yourself believe that what you're doing is necessary. Probably the voice of men who have been murdering and battering their wives and children for forever. The disgrace of, yeah. Throughout the 18th century, especially from the 1740s, European Freemasons spoke of being enlightened. But this term could have a variety of meanings, some vaguely intellectual, others symbolic, as was the use of metaphors about the light from the sun. I got your attention. Or the many dramatic effects intended at lodge meetings by the elaborate use of candles. In French orations, masters and brethren were routinely described and complimented as éclairé, in Dutch as verlichten, in German as afgetrakt. In Britain, one of the principal duties of a lodge was to initiate the unenlightened. Genevan Masons described themselves as the true children of the light. By mid-century, French Masonic ritual used to initiate an apprentice into a lodge asked what made him want to be released from his somber life. The answer given in the ritual was, as the means to be enlightened, I search the enlightened. In 1787, in a French language almanac, we have given ourselves the title of children of the light. I think it's a wonderful metaphor. Wonderful way of expressing our connection of what we are and how we describe that to ourselves and make sense of it. Who am I? That's an ongoing, I don't know. Can you come up with a sentence yet? The sentence that does it? The search to be enlightened doesn't need to have entailed the irreligious. Doesn't mean, we're all going to be atheists. We're all going to be, it doesn't mean that. That does not mean enlightenment, that we reject the Creator. There's something there that's very difficult to define. At one moment, we may embrace something very clearly and strongly, and at another, not so much. It might be replaced as a work in progress in our thinking with other ideas. In Masonic belief, being enlightened was inextricably tied to morality, to virtue. And in 1791, for example, one order spoke of the love of God, and in the very next sentence, the man philosophy, that is to say the truly wise, finds that there can be enough good, enough beauty, but there never can be enough virtue. In Philadelphia, revolutionary Freemasons in the late 1770s spoke about the liberty sought by patriots. They also spoke piously about being enlightened and enlivened by a ray from thee. They meant the deity. They also endorsed republicanism and revolution. In other occasions, American order spoke of the Copernican sun that unified and enlightened the universe and bound it together by the powerfully attractive influence of the divine principle of friendship, affection, and knowledge. Although mystical language about the sun was commonplace in Masonic rhetoric, it was the Newtonian sun, the centerpiece of the mechanism of the universe, placed there by the great architect, that was intended. Oh my, were we talking about something mystical? Or were we talking about the Newtonian, about the science? Oh, we want to keep that science secret, do we? We better do that. We don't want too many people to pick up our ideas. No, we could not ever embrace that idea. Not once. There is a small 18th century literature that links Freemasonry with the most extreme heresies of the Enlightenment and associates the lodges with materialism. We do know that the lodges could provide refuge to pantheists like Rousseau and to materialists like the French philosopher Helvetius, if you're looking for a font, Helvetius. Yet in provincial lodges such as we find in Strasbourg, funeral orators were particularly eager to make it clear that our order is founded on wise principles and rejects all materialism. Only in the early 19th century reaction against the French Revolution do we find Masonic rhetoric that is aggressively Christian. One of the most distinctive characteristics of Continental Freemasonry was its incessant creation of new degrees. And with that, interesting stuff. You'll have to join us again. You'll have to join us again. We're going to pick that up. And we'll explain a little bit more about our history, about the relevance. Thanks for the universe. Do we say thanks to each other for, let's acknowledge the universality of our order. Respect for your Grand Lodge and adherence and respect for the provisions and the protections of our Constitution are essential. Thank you, your Grand Master. Because there is a body of information, and we can expect great things from our Grand Masters. We can expect scholarship and well-thought-out ideas, as we can expect that from you and I. But Masonry isn't where we delegate the work of Masonry to our officials. No, far from it. We're far more the Republican. We're far more the roll up your sleeves and get at it a bunch. The first condition of understanding a foreign country is to smell it. Smell like. Who would say something like that? An interesting person would say something like that. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. A man's mind is wont to tell him more than seven watchmen sitting in a tower. Well, what are you going to do? Don't overthink the world. Get on with the business of it. Today, our work and our expression is to be slightly better today than we were yesterday, and slightly better tomorrow than we are today. Not braggarts. Not firsts, slightly better. We're not the people that judge whether we're first. We're not the judge of that, or whether we've lived a good life. That is somewhere else. So for our listeners in India and Brazil and France, I'm eternally in utterly grateful. Listeners that tune us in from Russia and Canada, I'm overwhelmed. We are, I hope, held together by ideas. And the fact that we live probably a very similar life. Oh, I don't like people shying away. The world is evolving. And you and I, to think that we can stop it, well, we know better. This audience isn't there. How to embrace that change and experience it is up to each one of us. Will you come back next week? I hope so. I look forward to being with you. We're closing in on Well, there's only 23 days left in this year. Where did it go?
We're closing in on the 10th anniversary of Masonic Effects.
10 years. And I know some of you have been loyal listeners from the beginning. Thank you so very much for joining us today. I'm going to send you away with a little clip from you know, you can tell I'm sort of partial to French jazz. Sorry. I've got something in my sleeve from Russia that's coming in, too. I think you'll really enjoy. Make the best of your day. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.